podcast for my mother. She read to me when I was little, so now I'm returning the favour and you're welcome to listen along. It's Thursday and that means I'm reading something offbeat. Sundays are for classics, but whatever I'm reading, it's always great writing. I'm recording this in Sydney in May 2022. For American listeners, your wonderful country, which I adore, is currently engaged in a bit of a political convulsion on the topic of abortion because of an upcoming US Supreme Court decision. Why would that cause a political convulsion? Well, because there is a possibility that the January 22, 1973 majority Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade could be overturned. A lot of people talk a lot about the US Supreme Court case Roe v. Wade. But who has actually read it? Me. And tonight I'm going to read Roe v. Wade for you. Edited for length, of course. What exactly is all the fuss about? Well, you're about to hear. Before I start, there are 9 judges on the US Supreme Court. In Roe v. Wade, 7 of them found that there was a right to privacy contained in the 14th Amendment to the US Constitution, and they found that abortion sat within that right, a woman's right to terminate her pregnancy. 2 judges, however, disagreed. But even in disagreement, there was still wonderful writing that we can enjoy on this very emotional subject. And don't imagine that because it's a legal judgment, it's going to be boring or difficult to understand. American legal judgments, particularly at the US Supreme Court level, are always fascinating and beautiful literary works, no matter the topic. So, Roe v. Wade. Let's begin. We forthwith acknowledge our awareness of the sensitive and emotional nature of the abortion controversy, of the vigorous opposing views, even among physicians, and of the deep and seemingly absolute convictions that the subject inspires. One's philosophy, one's experiences, one's exposure to the raw edges of human existence, one's religious training, one's attitude towards life and family and their values, and the moral standards one establishes and seeks to observe, are all likely to influence and to colour one's thinking and conclusions about abortion. Our task, of course, is to resolve the issue by constitutional measurement, free of emotion and of predilection. We seek earnestly to do this. And because we do, we have inquired into, and in this opinion, place some emphasis upon, medical and medical legal history, and what that history reveals about man's attitudes towards the abortion procedure over the centuries. The Texas statutes that concern us here make it a crime to procure an abortion, as therein defined, or to attempt one, except with respect to an abortion procured or attempted by medical advice for the purpose of saving the life of the mother. Similar statutes are in existence in a majority of the states. Jane Roe, a single woman who was residing in Dallas County, Texas, instituted this federal action in March 1970 against the district attorney of the county, Henry Wade. She sought a declaratory judgment that the Texas criminal abortion statutes were unconstitutional on their face. Roe alleged that she was unmarried and pregnant, that she wished to terminate her pregnancy by an abortion performed by a competent licensed physician under safe clinical conditions, that she was unable to get a legal abortion in Texas because her life did not appear to be threatened by the continuation of her pregnancy, and that she could not afford to travel to another jurisdiction in order to secure a legal abortion under safe conditions. She claimed that the Texas statutes were unconstitutionally vague and that they abridged her right to personal privacy, protected by the 1st, 4th, 5th, 9th, and 14th Amendments. Roe purported to sue on behalf of herself and all other women similarly situated. The principal thrust of Roe's attack on the Texas statutes is that they improperly invade a right said to be possessed by the pregnant woman to choose to terminate her pregnancy. Roe would discover this right in the concept of personal liberty embodied in the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. Before addressing this claim, we feel it desirable briefly to survey in several aspects the history of abortion for such insight as that history may afford us, and then to examine the state purposes and interests behind the criminal abortion laws. It perhaps is not generally appreciated that the restrictive criminal abortion laws in effect in a majority of states today are of relatively recent vintage. Those laws generally proscribing abortion or its attempt at any time during pregnancy, except when necessary to preserve the pregnant woman's life, are not of ancient or even of common law origin. Instead, they derive from statutory changes effected, for the most part, in the latter half of the 19th century. Ancient attitudes are not capable of precise determination. We are told that, at the time of the Persian Empire, abortifacients were known and that criminal abortions were severely punished. We are also told, however, that abortion was practiced in Greek times as well as in the Roman era, and that it was resorted to without scruple. The Ephesian, Soranos, often described as the greatest of the ancient gynecologists, appears to have been generally opposed to Rome's prevailing free abortion practices. He found it necessary to think first of the life of the mother, and he resorted to abortion when, upon this standard, he felt the procedure advisable. Greek and Roman law afforded little protection to the unborn. If abortion was prosecuted in some places, it seems to have been based on a concept of a violation of the father's right to his offspring. Ancient religion did not bar abortion. The Hippocratic Oath has stood long as the ethical guide to the medical profession. It bears the name of the great Greek who has been described as the father of medicine. The oath varies somewhat according to the particular translation, but in any translation, the content is clear. Quote, I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor suggest any such counsel. And in like manner, I will not give a woman a pessary to produce abortion. End quote. With the end of antiquity, a decided change took place. Resistance against suicide and against abortion became common. The Hippocratic Oath came to be popular. The emerging teachings of Christianity were in agreement with the ethic. The oath became the nucleus of all medical ethics and was applauded as the embodiment of truth. At common law, it is undisputed that abortion performed before the quickening, that is, the first recognizable movement of the fetus in utero, appearing usually from the 16th to the 18th week of pregnancy, was not an indictable offence. The absence of a common law crime for pre-quickening abortion appears to have developed from a confluence of earlier philosophical, theological, and civil and canon law concepts of when life begins. These disciplines variously approached the question in terms of the point at which the embryo or fetus became formed or recognizably human, or in terms of when a person came into being, that is, infused with a soul or animated. A loose consensus evolved in early English law that these events occurred at some point between conception and live birth. This was mediate animation. Although Christian theology and the canon law came to fix the point of animation at 40 days for a male and 80 days for a female, a view that persisted until the 19th century, there was otherwise little agreement about the precise time of formation or animation. There was agreement, however, that prior to this point, the fetus was to be regarded as part of the mother, and its destruction, therefore, was not homicide. In English statutory law, England's first criminal abortion statute came in 1803. It made abortion of a quick fetus a capital crime, but it provided lesser penalties for the felony of abortion before quickening, and thus it preserved the quickening distinction. This contrast was continued in the general revision in 1828. It disappeared, however, together with the death penalty in 1837, and did not reappear until 1861 in the Offences Against the Person Act that formed the core of English anti-abortion law until the liberalising reforms of 1967. The Abortion Act of 1967 permits a licensed physician to perform an abortion where two other licensed physicians agree that the continuance of the pregnancy would involve risk to the life of the pregnant woman, or that there is a substantial risk that if the child were born, it would suffer from such physical or mental abnormalities as to be seriously handicapped. The American law, in effect in all but a few states until the mid-19th century, was the pre-existing English common law concerning the quickening. Connecticut, the first state to enact abortion legislation, adopted in 1821 that part of the British Act related to a woman quick with child. The death penalty was not imposed. Abortion before quickening was made a crime in that state only in 1860. In 1828, New York enacted legislation that in two respects was to serve as a model for early anti-abortion statutes. First, while barring destruction of an unquickened fetus as well as a quick one, it made the former only a misdemeanor, but the latter was manslaughter. And second, it incorporated a concept of therapeutic abortion, by providing that an abortion was excused if it shall have been necessary to preserve the life of such mother, or shall have been advised by two physicians to be necessary for such purpose. By 1840, when Texas had received the common law, only 8 American states had statutes dealing with abortion. It was not until after the war between the states that legislation began generally to replace the common law. Most of these initial statutes dealt severely with abortion after quickening, but were lenient with it before quickening. Most punished attempts equally with completed abortions. While many statutes included the exception for an abortion thought by one or more physicians to be necessary to save the mother's life, that provision soon disappeared, and the typical law required that the procedure actually be necessary for that purpose. Gradually, in the middle and late 19th century, the quickening distinction disappeared from the statutory law of most states, and the degree of the offence and the penalties were increased. By the end of the 1950s, a large majority of the jurisdictions banned abortion, however and whenever performed, unless done to save or preserve the life of the mother. The exceptions, Alabama and the District of Columbia, permitted abortion to preserve the mother's health. 3 states permitted abortions that were not unlawfully performed or that were not without lawful justification, leaving interpretation of those standards to the courts. In the past several years, however, a trend toward liberalisation of abortion statutes has resulted in adoption, by about 1/3 of the states, of less stringent laws. It is thus apparent that at common law, At the time of the adoption of our Constitution, and throughout the major portion of the 19th century, abortion was viewed with less disfavour than under most American statutes currently in effect. Phrasing it another way, a woman enjoyed a substantially broader right to terminate a pregnancy than she does in most states today. At least with respect to the early stage of pregnancy, and very possibly without such a limitation, the opportunity to make this choice was present in this country well into the 19th century. Even later, the law continued for some time to treat less punitively an abortion procured in early pregnancy. The state has a legitimate interest in seeing to it that abortion, like any other medical procedure, is performed under circumstances that ensure maximum safety for the patient. This interest obviously extends at least to the performing physician and his staff, to the facilities involved, to the availability of aftercare, and to adequate provision for any complication or emergency that might arise. The prevalence of high mortality rates at illegal abortion mills strengthens rather than weakens the state's interest in regulating the conditions under which abortions are performed. Moreover, the risk to the woman increases as her pregnancy continues. The state's interest and general obligation to protect life extends, it is argued, to prenatal life. Only when the life of the pregnant mother herself is at stake, balanced against the life she carries within her, should the interest of the embryo or fetus not prevail. Logically, of course, a legitimate state interest in this area need not stand or fail on acceptance of the belief that life begins at conception or some other point prior to live birth. In assessing the state's interest, recognition may be given to the less rigid claim that as long as at least a potential life is involved, the state may assert interests beyond the protection of the pregnant woman alone. It is with these interests that this case is concerned. The Constitution does not explicitly mention any right of privacy. The right of privacy, if founded in the 14th Amendment's concept of personal liberty and restrictions on state action, as we feel it is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. The detriment that the state would impose upon the pregnant woman by denying this choice altogether is apparent. Specific and direct harm, medically diagnosable, even in early pregnancy, may be involved. Maternity or additional offspring may force upon the woman a distressful life and future. Psychological harm may be imminent. Mental and physical health may be taxed by child care. There is also the distress for all concerned associated with the unwanted child. And there is the problem of bringing a child into a family already unable, psychologically or otherwise, to care for it. In other cases, as in this one, the additional difficulties and continuing stigma of unwed motherhood may be involved. All these are factors the woman and her responsible physician necessarily will consider. On the basis of elements such as these, Roe and some others argue that the woman's right is absolute and that she is entitled to terminate her pregnancy at whatever time, in whatever way, and for whatever reason she alone chooses. With this, we do not agree. Roe's arguments that Texas either has no valid interest at all in regulating the abortion decision, or no interest strong enough to support any limitation upon the woman's sole determination, are unpersuasive. The court's decisions recognizing a right of privacy also acknowledge that some state regulation in areas protected by that right is appropriate. As noted above, a state may properly assert important interests in safeguarding health, in maintaining medical standards, and in protecting potential life. At some point in pregnancy, these respective interests become sufficiently compelling to sustain regulation of the factors that govern the abortion decision. The privacy right involved, therefore, cannot be said to be absolute. In fact, it is not clear to us that the claim asserted by some that one has an unlimited right to do with one's body as one pleases bears a close relationship to the right of privacy previously articulated in the court's decisions. The court has refused to recognise an unlimited right of this kind in the past, in respect of vaccination and sterilisation. We therefore conclude that the right of personal privacy includes the abortion decision, but that this right is not unqualified, and it must be considered against important state interests in regulation. Courts have agreed that the right of privacy, however based, is broad enough to cover the abortion decision, that the right nonetheless is not absolute and is subject to some limitations, and that at some point, the state interests as to the protection of health, medical standards, and prenatal life become dominant. We agree with this approach. The pregnant woman cannot be isolated in her privacy. She carries an embryo, and later a fetus, if one accepts the medical definitions of the developing young in the human uterus. The situation, therefore, is inherently different from marital intimacy, or bedroom possession of obscene material, or marriage, or procreation, or education. As we have intimated above, it is reasonable and appropriate for a state to decide that at some point in time, another interest, that of health of the mother, or that of potential human life, becomes significantly involved. The woman's privacy is no longer sole, and any right of privacy she possesses must be measured accordingly. Texas urges that apart from the 14th Amendment, life begins at conception and is present throughout the pregnancy, and that therefore the state has a compelling interest in protecting that life from and after conception. We need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. When those trained in the respective disciplines of medicine, philosophy, and theology are unable to arrive at any consensus, the judiciary, at this point in the development of man's knowledge, is not in a position to speculate as to the answer. It should be sufficient to note briefly the wide divergence of thinking on this most sensitive and difficult question. There has always been strong support for the view that life does not begin until live birth. This was the belief of the Stoics. It appears to be the predominant, though not unanimous, attitude of the Jewish faith. It may be taken to represent also the position of a large segment of the Protestant community, insofar as that can be ascertained. Organized groups that have taken a formal position on the abortion issue have generally regarded abortion as a matter for the conscience of the individual and her family. As we have noted, the common law found greater significance in quickening. Physicians and their scientific colleagues have regarded that event with less interest and have tended to focus either upon conception, on live birth, or upon the interim point at which the fetus becomes, quote, viable, end quote. That is, potentially able to live outside the mother's womb, albeit with artificial aid. Viability is usually placed at about 7 months, 28 weeks, but may occur earlier, even at 24 weeks. The Aristotelian theory of mediate animation that held sway throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance in Europe continued to be official Roman Catholic dogma until the 19th century, despite opposition to this ensoulment theory from those in the church who would recognise the existence of life from the moment of conception. The latter is now, of course, the official belief of the Catholic Church. This is a view strongly held by many non-Catholics as well, and by many physicians. Substantial problems for precise definition of this view are posed, however, by new embryological data that purport to indicate that conception is a process over time rather than an event, and by new medical techniques, such as menstrual extraction, the morning after pill, implantation of embryos, artificial insemination, and even artificial wombs. In areas other than criminal abortion, the law has been reluctant to endorse any theory that life, as we recognize it, begins before live birth, or to accord legal rights to the unborn, except in narrowly defined situations, and except where the rights are contingent upon live birth. In view of all this, we do not agree that by adopting one theory of life, Texas may override the rights of the pregnant woman that are at stake. With respect to the state's important and legitimate interest in the health of the mother, the compelling point, in the light of present medical knowledge, is at approximately the end of the first trimester. This is so because of the now established medical fact that until the end of the first trimester, mortality in abortion may be less than mortality in normal childbirth. It follows that from and after this point, a state may regulate the abortion procedure to the extent that the regulation reasonably relates to the preservation and protection of maternal health. This means that for the period of the pregnancy prior to this compelling point, the attending physician, in consultation with his patient, is free to determine without regulation by the state that, in his medical judgment, the patient's pregnancy should be terminated. If that decision is reached, the judgment may be effectuated by an abortion free of interference by the state. With respect to the state's important and legitimate interest in potential life, the compelling point is at viability. This is so because the fetus then presumably has the capability of meaningful life outside the mother's womb. State regulation protective of fetal life after viability thus has both logical and biological justifications. If the state is interested in protecting fetal life after viability, it may go so far as to prescribe abortion during that period, except where it is necessary to preserve the life or health of the mother. Measured against these standards, the Texas Penal Code, in restricting legal abortions to those procured or attempted by medical advice for the purpose of saving the life of the mother, sweeps too broadly. The statute makes no distinction between abortions performed early in pregnancy and those performed later, and it limits to a single reason, saving the mother's life, the legal justification for the procedure. The statute, therefore, cannot survive the constitutional attack made on it here. This conclusion makes it unnecessary for us to consider additional challenges on the basis of vagueness. To summarize and to repeat, a state criminal abortion statute of the current Texas type that accepts from criminality only a life-saving procedure on behalf of the mother, without regard to the pregnancy stage and without recognition of other interests involved, violates the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. For the stage prior to approximately the end of the first trimester, the abortion decision and its effectuation must be left to the medical judgment of the pregnant woman's attending physician. For the stage subsequent to approximately the end of the first trimester, the state, in promoting its interest in the health of the mother, may, if it chooses, regulate the abortion procedure in ways that are reasonably related to maternal health. For the stage subsequent to viability, the state, in promoting its interests in the potentiality of human life, may, if it chooses, regulate and even prescribe abortion, except where it is necessary, in appropriate medical judgment, for the preservation of the life or health of the mother. This holding, we feel, is consistent with the relative weights of the respective interests involved, with the lessons and examples of medical and legal history, with common law, and with the demands of the profound problems of the present day. the decision leaves the state free to place increasing restrictions on abortion as the period of pregnancy lengthens, so long as those restrictions are tailored to the recognized state interests. The decision vindicates the right of the physician to administer medical treatment according to his professional judgment, up to the points where important state interests provide compelling justifications for intervention. Up to those points, the abortion decision is in all aspects inherently and primarily a medical decision, and basic responsibility for it must rest with the physician. If an individual practitioner abuses the privilege of exercising proper medical judgment, the usual remedies, judicial and intra-professional, are available. Our conclusion that the Texas law is unconstitutional means, of course, that the Texas abortion statutes as a unit must fall. And that was the majority judgment in the case of Roe v. Wade. But what about the dissent? Well, here is Mr. Justice Rehnquist dissenting. The majority opinion brings to the decision of this troubling question both extensive historical fact and a wealth of legal scholarship. While the opinion thus commands my respect, I find myself nonetheless in fundamental disagreement and therefore dissent. To reach its result, the majority necessarily has had to find within the scope of the 14th Amendment a right that was apparently completely unknown to the drafters of the amendment. As early as 1821, the first state law dealing directly with abortion was enacted by the Connecticut legislature. By the time of the adoption of the 14th Amendment in 1868, there were at least 36 laws enacted by state or territorial legislatures limiting abortion. While many states have amended or updated their laws, 21 of the laws on the books in 1868 remain in effect today. Indeed, the Texas statute, struck down by the majority, was first enacted in 1857 and has remained substantially unchanged to the present time. There apparently was no question concerning the validity of this Texas law or of any of the other state statutes when the 14th Amendment was adopted. The only conclusion possible from this history is that the drafters did not intend to have the 14th Amendment withdraw from the states the power to legislate with respect to this matter. I respectfully dissent. And that's where we'll leave it tonight. What do you think now that you've actually heard Roe v. Wade? I do think the judges, all men by the way, and men in 1973, not the most progressive era, were trying very hard to be sensitive on such a difficult and emotional issue. But it is a very 1973 sensibility that we're hearing, would you agree? Because the finding is that in the first trimester, it's a matter for the physician to determine if an abortion is appropriate. There's a real focus on the role of the physician. Maybe you agree with the dissent, which focuses on the fact that abortion is not mentioned in the 14th Amendment. There's quite a gulf, it seems to me, between the different reasoning. And there has been a lot of case law since Roe v. Wade to, shall we say, more clarify American rights of abortion at a constitutional level. But they are court cases. And it does seem to me that abortion is the kind of topic that should be the subject of legislation by individual states. But what do I know? I'm just a podcaster from Sydney. I'd love to know your thoughts. So if you feel like dropping me an email, do to nudireads@gmail.com. Right, that's your legal lot. Plenty of food for thought. But I'll be back on Sunday, 9 p.m. Sydney time. And I wish you all a great and safe week wherever you are. Till next time then, take care. It's slippery out there. And thanks for listening to Nudie Reads.